The House Health and Social Services Committee will now come to order. It is 3:06 p.m. on Tuesday, January 30th in Capitol Room 106. Members present are Representative Eastman, Representative Keto, Representative Sullivan Leonard, Representative Tarr, Representative Johnston, and myself, Representative Spanholz. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Take a moment to silence your cell phones if you haven't already done that. Thank you. And then I want to thank Butch Carver, the House Hess Secretary, and bills and then adjourn at 4 p.m. for the start of the Department of Health and Social Services Finance Subcommittee. First up is House Bill 54 by Representative Harriet Drummond, allowing for terminally ill Alaskans to choose a death with dignity. We'll be discussing amendments and then looking to the will of the committee. Second, we'll hear House Bill 162 by the governor dealing with the DHSS background check processes. We'll begin public testimony hearing from the Department of Law and the State Ombudsman, and then we're going to set aside the bill for a future hearing so a little more work can be done on it. Third, we will hear House Bill 268 by Representative Les Guerra covering warnings for opioid prescriptions. We'll hear an initial presentation and then set the bill aside for future hearing. All right, now we're going to turn our attention to House Bill 54, Representative Drummond's Death with Dignity legislation. Representative Drummond and Mr. McCormick, if you can come forward, put yourself on the record and give us a quick recap of the bill prior to the committee taking action on the legislation.
Hello, my name is Patrick Fitzgerald, and I am staff of Representative Harriet Drummond.
Thank you, Chair Spanholz. This is my first time sitting at this brand new testimony table that our office organized for this room. I hope you enjoy it.
It allows more than one and a quarter people
to sit in front of you and for four full seats at the side table. So when they're joint committees, it works better. So it's delightful to be before you today. Thank you, members of House Health and Social Services. For the record, I am Harriet Drummond, representative of House District 18. House Bill 54 is about patients' rights and end-of-life care. It allows patients to make important end-of-life decisions with their own doctors they already know and already trust. It allows a patient to ease their suffering, to live and to die on their own terms, according to their own beliefs. We went through the bill at the last hearing in the spring of 2017. I'd like to let you know what has transpired since then. A survey of over 600 Alaskans was conducted that showed that just over 70% of voting Alaskans support an end-of-life option such that this bill allows. Along with the survey, local community support is rising. The Kodiak Island Borough Assembly passed a resolution in support of House Bill 54 last fall, as did the Girdwood Board of Supervisors. I'm here to encourage your support of this bill on its journey through the legislature, as it will give an end-of-life choice to Alaskans that want this choice. I understand that there will be an amendment regarding written consent, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right, are there any questions for Representative Drummond and the sponsor, her staff? Sullivan Leonard?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a little bit curious. I know we do try to pull together data and what have you in a scientific matter. So I'm looking at the survey here. How did that come about? Who paid for the survey? How was that then processed then across the state?
That company that Alaska, I forget the name of the company, but they run a regular survey on a quarterly basis, and they will add questions that you may want on a survey, and our office account paid for it.
Okay, and how much was that?
I want to say $1,600 to $1,800, something like that.
Okay. Any other questions for Representative Drummond? Representative Sadler, I'm observing that you're an alternate, and we seem to have a full complement today. All right. Any other questions? All right. Seeing none, I'll open up the bill for amendments from the committee. I have one amendment. I move amendment number one, work order 30-LS. Is that O? O254/0.1, or maybe it's backwards. Yeah, backwards. It was 0254/0.1.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion.
All right, thank you. So the purpose for this amendment is to include in statute a requirement that a terminally ill individual's desire for life-ending medication be written down and be witnessed by two individuals. Of those individuals, only one may be related to the individual entitled to a portion of the estate of which the individual whose life will be ending or be employed by the health care facility where the individual is living or receiving treatment. So we can't have two interested parties, for example, sign off on it. There's an exemption to the written requirement if the individual doesn't possess the capacity to directly physically sign the document. In that case, the individual may direct another person to sign on their behalf. On pages 2 and 3 of the amendment, the form of the written request, including the witnessing aspect, is spelled out. On page 5, lines 1 through 2, the written request waiting period is outlined. Page 5, lines 10 through 11, outlines the documentation requirement.
Madam Chair, I'll remove my objection.
Are there any other objections?
I object.
Okay. All right, we have an objection from Sullivan Leonard and a question from Representative Eastman.
Thank you. My question would be, I understand that there's been a number of cases where individuals have submitted a request for medication, uncertain of whether or not they wanted to actually go through with that, but keeping that as an option, or appeasing those who wanted them to consider that as an option. Would the witnesses here who are part of getting them the medication, would those witnesses, any of them, have to be present during the administration of the medicine?
No.
Okay.
Is there any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative Johnston.
Yes, I have to say, I was just reading this earlier rather quickly, but let's see. On line 7 of page 2, you have, if the qualified individual is an inpatient or long-term care facility, so it says designated by the facility has the qualifications established by the department by regulation, so that the by regulation is on the facility, not on the person. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Eastman, it's like ping pong.
Thank you. Yes. Now, I know the concerns regarding coercion came up earlier last year. In the case of a particular individual, there were concerns about coercion, would that prohibit the written request from going through, or would that not have an effect?
I believe the idea is that the written request is to document and ensure that the coercion wasn't in place.
And if there was a situation of coercion in one instance and that was dealt with, would that prohibit this from going through as sort of a second attempt? Or would that be treated as an entirely separate
situation? Second attempt at an individual choosing to end their life, or a second? I imagine that the individual would still have autonomy to choose to end their life, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Is there any other questions? Would you like to speak to your objection, Representative Sullivan Leonard?
No, I'm good.
All right. Do you maintain your objection?
Yes,
all right.
Madam Chair, I do.
Would the clerk please call the roll?
No.
Representative Tarr.
Yes.
Representative Quito.
Yes.
Representative Edgman.
Yes.
Representative Eastman.
No.
Representative Johnston.
Yes.
Chair Sponholz.
Yes.
5 yeas, 2 nays.
All right, and with 5 yeas and 2 nays, Amendment 1 has been adopted. Are there any other amendments from committee members today? All right, seeing none, are there any other points of discussion? All right. All right. Representative Eastman.
One of the questions that came up in talking with constituents was what exactly is going to appear on the death certificate? And so I'm curious if that's I'm trying to remember where the discussion was left last year on the death certificate. So if someone goes through this process and checks all the blocks and is dead because of this process, what happens on their death certificate? And I understand that's a concern because if for some reason there was foul play, if you know, a death of natural causes listed on the death certificate, then that would prohibit law enforcement from pursuing, you know, some type of charges against someone.
All right. I've asked Representative Drummond and her staff to come up and address the question.
Thank you. Representative Drummond, House District 18. I believe that the diagnosis that appears on the death certificate, is the diagnosis that would have killed the person, their terminal illness. So if it's brain cancer or multiple sclerosis or Lou Gehrig's disease. I'm sorry, I don't know the technical names of these diseases, some of these diseases, but that is my understanding. That is what will appear on the death certificate, as that would have killed them anyway had they not chosen to end their life using the prescriptions that for which this written consent is requesting.
Follow-up?
Proceed.
So then from a legal perspective, it would be as though they hadn't engaged in this process entirely. It would be as though this bill didn't exist, this process didn't exist, and they had just died of natural causes. Is that right?
I think so.
Okay. Thank you.
I think so.
All right. Are there any other questions? You're an alternate, and we have a full contingent here.
I just wanted, for the record, I need to establish that as an alternate, I'm not allowed to vote in this bill, and as alternate, you're not allowing me to debate the issue. Is that correct? I just want to get that.
My understanding is that an alternate is to make sure that your caucus is properly represented.
Thank you.
And that you're here for informational purposes.
I just want to make it clear that I'm not speaking because okay. Others are speaking, not because I can't or don't want to. Thank you.
Understood. Good. Anybody else? All right. Seeing none, I would entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 54, Work Order 30-LS0254/O, as amended from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Is there an objection?
Yes, I object.
All right, would you like to speak to your objection?
Yes, I would. Thank you, Madam Chair. My concerns in this bill are squarely on the side of what happens when what's supposed to happen doesn't happen. And certainly one of the chief roles of the state of government is to protect an individual's right to life. And I am especially concerned that in our intention of creating a path for things to happen, that as is often the case, people will abuse that and will take advantage and will pressure or coerce or force people to be victims of having their life ended before it would have otherwise. I'm very concerned that there's no requirement for any witnesses to be present when the drugs are administered. If there's no witness and all you have is a dead body and all you have on the death certificate is they died of natural causes, from a law enforcement perspective, that's a very difficult thing to investigate. If, in fact, something did take place that was criminal and illegal and resulted in the death of a person. And I believe that if that's the best we can do, that we are not fulfilling our role of protecting an individual's right to life, or in the event that their life is taken criminally, to prosecute those who took that life criminally. And I also understand that the age requirement on participating in this process is very low, to the extent where you could have very young people who have been diagnosed with diseases who are being killed through this process. And I think it's shocking that we would be allowing this process to go forward for teenagers. But according to the bill language currently, we do permit this to be used on teenagers. And I think that is also a mistake. So because of the opportunity for abuse and misuse, as happens in all aspects of healthcare and government from time to time, I'll be a no vote.
Thank you. Does anybody else have any comments they'd like to make? Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to echo the comments of my colleague. I, too, do not support this bill. I do believe in the sanctity of life from beginning to end. Having witnessed my own family members pass away from cancer, I do understand those that wish to impose this particular law, but I also understand a very critical aspect of the Christian faith that is involved with the sanctity of life, and I do believe it's very important that is something that continues, again, from beginning to end. The other part of it, too, is, I've studied the Oregon concept of this particular bill. Because Oregon says it so doesn't mean Alaska should say it. It should be a concept we should follow. It's a very controversial bill, and it's not something I can support. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. Is there anybody else who'd like to make comments? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to appreciate the comments of the previous two speakers. I definitely struggled with this, not the concept, because I guess I think, who am I to say that another person should have to experience pain or suffering in a way, like some of this really sad stories have been shared with us or, shared through reading about, some of that more high profile instances where someone has considered this option. But, again, for me, it's not for me to say. I think, that individual has the right to make that choice on their own. But I was concerned about vulnerable populations, particularly seniors or individuals with disabilities. So I just want to point out, just for anyone watching, that on page 2, that, the things an individual shall, and number 3, have been determined by a court, the individual's attending physician, the individual's consulting physician, the individual's psychiatrist, or the individual psychologist to be capable. So that really helps, I think, with protections for someone with a developmental disability or something like limited intellectual capacities, and wanted to be sure that protection was in there. And then also part B of that, an individual does not qualify under A of this section solely because of the individual's age or disability. And so that, again, brings up my concern with, individuals with a disability. And then I think an age in that part is more leaning on the senior side of things. And I definitely, I know from own family experience that some of our elders, they do start to feel like they're a bit of a burden on the family, and as their health deteriorates and they have more significant needs, it can be a challenge, particularly if your family's not well-resourced and doesn't have access to good health care. I had those concerns, but I think the language is pretty restrictive here because it's a shall, and it's both, covered in the statute there, and that's what does give me comfort that those issues have been addressed sufficiently for me to support this moving forward. The witness issue that was just brought up, I think, is a interesting, and I wish I'd kind of been thinking of that before, or that might have been brought to my attention, an interesting component of that. But I hope the sponsor will consider that, idea being brought forward as the bill continues through the process. Thank you.
Does anybody else have any comments they'd like to make? So before I call for a vote, I just want to make a couple of comments. I appreciate the thoughtfulness with which people are approaching this. This is a pretty serious situation. But I also think that the right to everybody's ability to make their own decisions for their own body is very important, that's a basic fundamental right that we as Americans enjoy. I think that this bill has put in place some safeguards, including the written requirement
that we adopted today was important to me, to sort of just as a matter of process to make sure that, you know, we have sort of this process that people have to go to documenting their concerns. It's also important to me as a loved one to know that if, you know, somebody I cared for very deeply made this decision, that, you know, they'd gone through this process and that I'd be able to see that, and it would, you know, give me comfort. I want to just, you know, notice for those folks that may be watching this that on page 7 and 8 of the bill, starting on page 7, starting with line 27, there's a new section that's established. It's section 13.55.180, which clearly establishes criminal penalties for anybody who commits the crime of abuse of life-ending process if the person, you know, with the intent to cause the individual's death or knowing the death of the individual is substantially certain to result. I'm going to conclude it, that this is a Class A felony. That's an equivalent with murder in the state of law and may be punished as provided in AS 1255. So in no way are we legalizing anything other than giving the individual the right to make their own choices with their bodies. We are not giving anybody else the right to choose to end our lives, you know, any individual's life that is not their own. And for me, that's a very important part of this bill. With that, is the objection maintained?
Yes.
All right. Would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Johnston.
Pass.
Representative Sullivan Leonard.
No.
Representative Tarr.
Yes.
Representative Quito.
Yes.
Representative Edgman.
Yes.
Representative Eastman.
No.
Representative Johnston.
Yes.
Chair Sponholz.
Yes.
5 yeas, 2 nays.
All right, and with a vote of 5 yeas and 2 nays, House Bill 54 passes from committee, and we're now going to go to at ease while we sign the paperwork and the committee report. to House Bill 162, which deals with the Department of Health and Social Services background check system. Stacey Crailey, Chief Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law, would you please come forward, put yourself on the record, and give us a brief recap of the legislation?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Stacey Crailey, Chief Assistant Attorney General, State of Alaska Department of Law. Briefly, I appreciate the opportunity to come back and speak with the committee. As I testified, I think it was just last week, HB 162 is a legislative fix to existing statutes found in Title 47, specifically the background check statutory scheme found at 4705-300 and the licensing statutes found in 4732. Specifically, this bill is what I would characterize as a technical fix that arises out of a number of issues that have come to our attention over the course of the last 15 years to identify a number of gaps, overlaps, redundancies, squishy language, whatever you want to call it. Just need to clean up some things that need to be done statutorily, and that's the impetus of the bill.
All right, thank you. Is there any questions for Ms. Crailey while we have her? Just finding the right place there. All right. Since there's no questions for you right now, Mr. Crailey, we're going to go ahead and open the bill up for public testimony. All right. First off, is there anyone in the room who'd like to testify? All right. Thank you. Want to introduce yourself?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Kate Burkhart, and I'm the Alaska State Ombudsman, and I'm here today to offer some comment based on a previous ombudsman investigation of the background check program to help inform your deliberations. Before I get to my comment, I just want to clarify, since this is my first appearance in front of the committee in this role, the ombudsman is an independent, nonpartisan, and objective organization that investigates complaints about state government. And when those complaints are found to be justified, makes recommendations for the improvement of government policies and programs. It is not an advocacy role. So the ombudsman would only comment on issues that either directly affected our work or where our work might provide information that would inform your deliberations, just to provide some context. The ombudsman's office has developed an understanding of the background check program based on an extensive investigation that was concluded in 2016 and reported. That information is relevant to HB 162 and some of the provisions in the bill. And so my comments are offered to inform the bill moving forward and not recommending that our previous recommendations should be taken in lieu of what's in the bill, just to be clear about that. You have written comment. A couple of highlights are, one, our investigation found, and Ms. Crailey has explained in her testimony last week, there is, in fact, no unique registry associated with the background check program. HB 162 provides an opportunity to really clarify that in statute. The bill as written refers to a civil registry, which still implies that there is some magic background check registry, when in fact it's a program that checks pre-existing registries held in other places. And so to be fair to folks who are subject to the background check program, HB 162 could clarify that. Another issue that is relevant to the information that we found in our investigation is the standard for a civil barrier. Prior to 2012, the background check program used the standard for civil barriers that included substantiated reports of child maltreatment, reports of harm to the Office of Children's Services. And that's what's in HB 162. But in 2012, the department started using a more robust standard that looked to findings from a court in a child in need of aid proceeding. And given the far-reaching impact of the civil barriers in the background check program, the recommendations that the Ombudsman's Office made in the past were to use the more robust standard of adjudicated findings. That also provides notice, an opportunity for due process in a court, whereas a substantiated report of harm doesn't always. To be very clear, the background check program is an essential component to the systems that serve vulnerable Alaskans. And so nothing in my comments or the information we share from our office should be interpreted to in any way minimize the importance of the program. And HB 162 provides the opportunity to strengthen the program. We've also provided some information about the importance of notice to people who may become subject to the background check program in the future. If the decision is made to use a substantiated report of harm as a basis for a civil barrier under the background check program, and that's a policy decision for you, then the notice to people about whom a report has been substantiated needs to be really clear because it will affect them for up to 10 years down the road. Right now, that notice is not so clear, and so having an express provision in the bill that requires that the person be put on notice that inclusion in the Child Protection Registry could have effects on their ability to take a caregiving job, like a personal care attendant or a child care provider, or to become a relative placement for a child that's in OCS custody. So again, whatever the policy decision is, providing clear and accessible notice to the people that it might affect is important. And so in the interest of time, because I know you have another bill coming up and you want to be done by 4, I'll leave you with the written comment. We do believe it's an important program, and 162 provides the opportunity to strengthen the program. And so while we provide this information from our previous investigation, it's really meant to inform the process moving forward and not to drag us all back to recommendations that were made a couple of years ago.
And just to be clear with everyone, I think I mentioned earlier, but it's my intention not to try to move this bill today so that we can take action and, you know, try to incorporate any this feedback that, you know, we're getting additional essentially intelligence or information, and I want to make sure that we have plenty of opportunity to incorporate that in. So we will not be moving this bill today, just to be clear, and Stacey Kralik with the Department of Law knows that as well. Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a few questions, if I could. Hi, I have your report here, most recent, with regard to your overview of this particular program. And on page 2 of 5, at the top paragraph, there's a statement that says 12 of the recommendations for addressing certain allegations with HESS, that there was an agreement to implement 3 of those particular recommendations from the Ombudsman. But that hasn't been done as of yet. Can you just highlight real quickly what the 12 recommendations were from your perspective and what at least the 3 changes that you were referring to?
Sure.
Okay.
Representative Sullivan Leonard through the chair. So the report is lengthy.
Right.
So if you go towards the very end on page 35, you have the department's response. And just in case you're unfamiliar with the ombudsman process, so the ombudsman issues a confidential preliminary report to a state agency. They have the chance to respond, and then a final report is issued. And then an executive summary, believe it or not, this was the executive summary, is published if the issue is of public interest. And so the department's response is always included in the final report. So that's on page 35. The department was in the midst of a regulatory process as well as proposing a bill similar to this 4 years ago, to last session. So, and so that, I think, was a part of their intention to implement recommendations 9 and 10, which they said that they were going to evaluate to see if they could be implemented through that regulatory process. And that's on page 42, if you're following along.
Actually, Ms. Burkhardt, I'm not sure that most, if any, of the committee members have that report, actually. So
and then the fourth and fifth recommendations, which were, they're not relevant to 162, but I'll go over them. So when the department changed the standard they were using from a substantiated report of harm to the adjudicated child in need of aid findings, the ombudsman recommended that they tell folks that they had changed the standard and allow them to resubmit to the background check program for screening under that heightened standard. And the department agreed that they would, within the next 6 months, notify people so they'd have the chance to try again in order to seek employment, and to notify individuals who'd been denied the ability to access the reconsideration process. So again, that's not relevant to 162, but those were the recommendations in response to your question. And again, the report is interesting, and it's got a lot of factual information, and it explains how the background check program affects individuals. But for the purposes of 162, it's context. It's not necessarily completely on point with the bill, but it does help inform some of the decisions about the bill.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any other questions for Ms. Burkhardt while we have her? Representative Tarr, thank you for the reminder.
Oh, yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to ask, similar to what Rep. Sullivan Leonard just asked, but did you mention the numbers 9 and 10? And I'm sorry if I missed it. I might have missed that just as I was taking notes.
Representative Tarr, through the chair, recommendation 9 had to do with taking another look at whether really old findings in child in need of aid cases should be a permanent bar to employment. HB 162 maintains the way things are now, which is the only permanent bar related to child protection is termination of parental rights. So again, 9 is not necessarily super relevant to 162. And then 10 had to do with implementing a tiered response system. And if you look at the regulations that were adopted last year, those do include a tiered response system, particularly with criminal barriers. I have no comment on the criminal barrier side of this because we didn't investigate that. And I don't have opinions about things we haven't investigated.
Mm-hmm. All right. Anything else? Thank you. All right. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Crayley, did you want to come back up and just respond briefly on the record so everybody's in the loop about our communications?
Thank you, and again for the record, Stacey Crayley, Chief Assistant Attorney General, Department of Law. I would like to thank the Ombudsman, Ms. Burkhardt, for her comments and her suggestions. We have been in communication with her office significantly and substantially long before she was the ombudsman, with the prior ombudsman, about the original report, and then recently, so we've spoken at length at least twice in the last 4 or 5 days about this bill and about how to move forward and how to improve the process, and we look forward to continuing those conversations both with her office and with this committee and other committees to make this bill as solid as it needs to be.
Fantastic. And just to clarify for everybody, it's my understanding that Ms. Crayley and Ms. Burkhardt will be meeting and making some recommendations that we could incorporate then either as an amendment or as a committee substitute. So just so everybody's clear that this is in process. So thank you.
Yes.
All right. And then we have one more person at the Anchorage LIO who wanted to testify, that I'd like to give the opportunity to do that since he's been waiting patiently for about 45 minutes. Charles McGee?
Yes, Charles McGee, M-C-K-E-E. Now, I was looking at this bill, and my experience with the state of Alaska and the medical facilities. When I was 14, I went to Pasadena Hospital because of the 67 flood, and it saved my life. I have yet acquired a Social Security card number yet that gave me an account of that process called bankruptcy of the Republic, HDR 192. After that, I had acquired a bank the account number unknowingly. I didn't register. So the state of Alaska, being a public corporation, by its foreign trade zone, underneath the state of Alaska, I mean, underneath the United States of America, federal corporation, 28 U.S.C. 3002, in parentheses, 15.
Mr. McGee, can I interrupt for just a second? Do you have testimony on House Bill 162?
That's exactly what I'm talking about.
Okay, perhaps you could focus in a little bit.
The registration of the individual and that account number that encompasses the payment of medical services would be a workers' comp. So when you have a licensed individual working for the state, they learn how to work the system. Now, we're talking about it bleeds over into the legal department, the Alaska Bar Association, and licensed professionals have learned the system. So, like a mediation on workers' comp.
Mr. McGee, House Bill 162 is about background checks. It's not a central registry for all Alaskans. This is just about background checks for people who have had potentially reports of harm or crimes.
Why are you registering individuals' limited liability under the state of Alaska Public Corporation under the recording office?
All right. Thank you for your testimony today, Mr. McGee. So in the interest of time, I'm going to go ahead and leave public testimony open, and then we're going to set this bill aside so that for further consideration by the committee at a future meeting. All right, now we're going to turn our attention to our third bill of the day. It's House Bill 268 by Representative Les Guerra, which covers warnings regarding opioid prescriptions. And Representative Guerra and his staff are going to come forward and give us a quick summary of the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. How much time would you like me to take? I know this is the first hearing. You intend to have a more detailed hearing later?
We intend to have a more detailed hearing later, and any additional time you take just eats into the Finance Subcommittee for HESS, so it's your call, Mr. Chair.
What time is it?
It is.
All right.
It is 3:49.
Thank you.
11 minutes, then, okay, before you start eating into your own time.
All right. I think you've made that clear. Thank you. I'd like to introduce my aide, Claire Gross, and I will give you an overview of the bill. The Centers for Disease Control have a recommendation. It's an important recommendation, and it's that physicians let patients know the dangers of opioid drugs. It's non-binding. It's not enforceable. New Jersey has made it enforceable. They've adopted a law asking physicians to let their patients know of the potential addictive qualities of opioid drugs. Let me just share a few facts, and maybe they'll make clear, if you don't already know from the last opioid bill hearings we've had, why it's important. Roughly 91 people in the United States die every year from opioid overdoses, 91 people a day. I'm sorry, 91 people a day, So you might think we don't have statistics from Alaska, or you might expect that Alaska is worse, and it's the latter. In Alaska, the per capita rate of death is twice as high as the national rate. We know that roughly 80% of people who use heroin started out on opioid and other related prescription drugs. We know for a fact that we in the United States have tripled the level of opioid drug prescriptions over the last decade or decade and a half. We know these drugs are dangerous. They're dangerous to your heart system. They're dangerous to your brain. And the danger manifests itself in terms of broken families, destroyed lives, increased health care costs, and more. In Alaska, 774 people have died from opioid overdoses between 2009 and 2015. I think Dr. Jay Butler will be able to break that down between prescription opioids and others, and I believe that includes heroin as well. The cost of treatment, the average cost of treatment for an opioid or heroin addict is roughly $30,000 a year. Often that is paid for by the state. And we know from the last bill that we passed and from the CDC that longer use of opioids increases the chances of addiction. So at 5 days, and then at 10 days, and then at 15 days, and then at 20 days, the chances of addiction become staggering from a public health standpoint and a family preservation standpoint. We like to think of things as Alaska problems. We know this is an American problem. I was in New Zealand, fortunately, for a vacation with my wife. It's a world problem. It was a front page problem in New Zealand. This is an issue I think that's going on because heroin is cheap, and then once people become addicted to opioids, and if they can't get them anymore from their doctor, they move over to the worst drug. So the bill does two things. It requires a doctor, in their own words, and it seeks to make the bill as non-burdensome as possible to medical professionals. And when I said doctor, I meant medical professionals, not just doctors. Medical professionals with prescribing authority, and that's a number of medical professionals. It says, in their own words, they shall let their patients know that extended use of opioid drugs could be addictive. And to make things easier on doctors and nurses and the other prescribers, we asked the Department of Health and Social Services to put a link up on their website that physicians can use to download a handout. And the sponsor statement says that'll be a concise handout because we want people to read it. The bill, somehow the word concise got lost in the bill, so that'll be an amendment to conform to the sponsor statement, I hope, at some point. We don't want the handout to be so long that people won't read it, like the thing that you get with the drugs that you get from your pharmacist that nobody reads. I will say personally, I've spoken to probably about 50 people to make sure that they've had the same experience as I have. I think, never, when prescribed an opioid drug, been told that they are potentially addictive. I've never been told that there's any link between opioid use and eventual heroin use. I've never been told anything along those lines at all. I've had broken ribs and been prescribed those drugs. That was 3 years ago. I've had two back surgeries. I've had a toe surgery, and never. And in all of the people I've spoken to on this, and I've surveyed about 50, I think about three people answered that they were told this. I've heard from one person who spoke to a physician that the physician didn't want to do this because they don't know enough about opioids. And I would say that is the reason for this bill. If there are physicians out there who can't learn, and most physicians are wonderful. Almost all physicians are wonderful. But a physician can learn the same things that we learned in a bill hearing. Those of us who aren't doctors or optometrists or nurse practitioners. And the federal government is asking physicians to do this. So this bill requires basically what the federal government recommends doctors do right now.
We have a question from Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, through the chair. Representative Guerra, thank you for bringing this bill forward. You kind of prompted me to think about kind of a different concept as well, and I do see it in some of your supporting documentation here, and that is with regard to not only informing the patient of the addictive properties of opioid, but also the choice of another pain-relieving substance that would be non-narcotic-based. I've talked to pharmaceutical reps over the years who have tried to bring this forward to the doctors, and they say, we don't want to use it because the patients want quick relief. Is there something maybe that could be considered as well in this type of bill?
Yeah, Representative Sullivan Leonard, you hit the nail on the head, and as we were researching this, we learned exactly what you did. The bill also requires, if there's a reasonable alternative to an opioid, that the doctor mention that to the patient. It's the patient's choice. The doctor can recommend what the doctor or prescriber feels is the best, but if there is a reasonable alternative, the prescriber needs to let the patient know about that too.
Representative Johnston?
Yes, and I have to say I have not read the bill yet. But does this bill, is this just for written prescriptions? Or, I mean, I'm thinking of instances where opioids are prescribed and a patient is probably not of any level to read anything.
Thank you, Representative Johnston. It is intended for written prescriptions, we will have to flesh out that we have the right language from Dr. Butler. There are some kinds of there's opioid use that's not prescription opioid use. If you're in a hospice care center, for example, you may be on opioids just as a palliative measure. This will not affect a hospice center. It won't. Obviously, there are places where you have to use opioids, like heroin addiction treatment. So it doesn't affect them, but it is intended to affect any treatment and use that requires a prescription from a provider who has the right to authorize a prescription. So actually, in response to your question, we should have Dr. Butler, and I will talk to Dr. Butler. Are there situations where you're in an institutional setting? I think if you're inside a hospital for, let's say, 5 days, I think you are going to get a prescription for something. I think you will have a doctor or a provider there, and I think it will apply there. So so I'm now rethinking my answer.
A follow-up. I'm thinking of cases of trauma.
Right.
And emergency rooms.
Thank you.
Yeah.
We would want to make sure it's written properly the way it is right now to not affect emergency rooms and immediate care and things like that, if that's what you're asking.
Well, and just to follow up on that, there are times in ERs when you can give consent and times when you can't give consent. So the crafting of that has to be very narrow. I have two other folks that have questions, Representatives Tarr and then Sadler is next after that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A few things here. Just my own personal preference to not have legislative findings in statute, but I won't. That's not going to bother me if that stays in. But on the section 10 on page 11, where one thing that I think could be missing from this conversation is just if people are saying that doctors aren't able to share this information because of lack of comfort level. One of the things that needs to be described, I think, for a patient to understand the problem is, what's happening in your brain with the opioid. So what's the mechanism of action? And because even if you take them for a few days, people might experience some kind of depression or something after that. And so people need to be prepared for that. And so anyhow, I just think that might be something to work in, sort of like health effects after your prescription's over, even if you haven't come to the point where you have an addiction, because if people aren't well prepared for that, that's when they tend to go back to using the drug because they have the depression kind of crash, and then when you take the drug again, then you feel back to the quote-unquote normal that you were adjusting to. So Dr. Butler is definitely a better person to speak about that, but I just think that may be something that would be helpful in that communication for patient understanding. But the other part was, I just wonder on page 12, the section here with the Department of Health and Social Services, if this is something they might consider doing absent legislation, because it seems like this is something they could do right away that has, potential positive effects, like as soon as it's posted on their website. And it seems like consistent with what they've done with having a task force and things like that. I don't know if there's a reason to not do it like that, but just wonder if they would consider that.
Through the chair. On the latter, I don't believe the department would require doctors to read a statement. I don't believe the department would require a doctor or nurse practitioner to provide a handout. The CDC, like the department, I think, has said, obviously, you should think about it, but I don't think they would make that. I think that's where you need legislation. This is a mandatory requirement, and I think that is something that's a subject for legislation. On your other question, I'll certainly do what the will of the committee wants in terms of the warning. Just be careful. If the warning gets too long, physicians aren't going to provide it, or they're going to resist very strongly. So there's a balance between providing the information that a patient will absorb and maybe the additional information you mentioned might be in might, if it's appropriate, go in the written part that you hand out to the patient. To doctors have a certain amount of time, nurse practitioners have a certain amount of time to meet with patients, and we have to balance that.
Just a brief follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I may have misunderstood. I thought you at one point mentioned something about the department putting something on their website, and that was the part I wondered if that could happen more immediately. The later part of it would be linking to the mandatory requirement with the doctors, but it just seems like, you know, given the crisis situation, if they would do something like that or have already, maybe they have, and I don't know. And if I knew, then maybe I could share that information too.
Through the chair, they do have it on their website, okay. And it's in very usable form. It's up to a provider to use right now.
Mm-hmm. And just to follow up on that, the Office of Substance Misuse and Prevention has a lot of information and resources available to the public and healthcare practitioners who wish to have additional information. Representative Sadler, since we have an absent committee member, you get to participate.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will not abuse the privilege, but through the chair, Representative Garrett, the bill would establish a standard for providing information about the addictive nature of opioid drugs, and I'm concerned about the extent to which this might tend to impinge on a physician's professional judgment. So my question to you, sir, is who decides what constitutes without good cause failing to provide information? Is that other physicians? Is that something we should leave to physicians' discretion? Is there some other definition of good cause that I'm missing? I appreciate your help.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Sadler. We want to make this bill as non-burdensome on doctors and other practitioners as possible. And we didn't want to create a hostile litigation relationship between a patient and a provider. So what you're reading is the discipline part for the various providers for not following this bill. Mm-hmm. We made it very relaxed. Number one, there's no lawsuit liability that's created by this bill. No new cause of action. The enforcement mechanism is if you are a habitual violator of the provisions of this bill, not a once or twice violator, a habitual violator, and you didn't have good cause. Good cause could be you're in a rural area and you had no paper that day to print out the handout. But yes, you'd have to be a habitual provider with a habitual violator with no good cause to be disciplined.
And again, so you've kind of raised my next question. I'm still not sure who defines good cause and what constitutes habitual. And I do appreciate there's no new cause of action. I do appreciate your goal, but I guess if it comes to law, someone's going to say, well, this did not constitute a good cause, or it did constitute a good cause, or it may have been twice a week, but it wasn't habitual. So I'm trying to probe as to where that line is defined.
Through the chair, I think you answered the question yourself when you said it might have been once or twice a week, or it might be habitual. It's only if it's habitual, if you are not following the law on a consistent basis.
All right, Representative Kito.
Chair, Representative Gara. So, given that there is a violation and I guess issues for habitual denial, how are the violations determined, and who determines those violations?
Through the chair, Representative Kito, the board for the profession determines those violations, and they will determine whether or not to punish somebody. The term habitual will be, as is usually the legal standard, the dictionary definition of habitual, but it will be decided by the members of the board that regulates the profession.
Follow up.
Proceed.
Thank you. Through the chair, and how are the board members made aware of a violation?
Through the chair, somebody would have to complain to them. I think it's going to be pretty rare. I don't think doctors or nurse practitioners or optometrists are going to want to violate the law. I think it'll be pretty rare, but somebody would have to bring it to them. Maybe a nurse within the office, some other person within the office who knows that their boss is not following the law. Maybe a patient who's gone there regularly and never been given a warning.
All right, and we're going to leave that as the last question for the day. There's certainly a bit of grist for the mill there. We're going to hold this over to a future committee for future discussion and public testimony. On Thursday, we're going to hear a presentation from the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education. The time is 4:07, and this hearing of House Health and Social Services Committee is now adjourned. The HES Finance Subcommittee, please stick around. We'll start immediately.